Chapter 10. The brilliant blue sky, free of clouds, allowed the sun to beat down and turn Pitt's black neoprene wetsuit into a skin-tight sauna bath as he checked the old single-hose U.S. diver's Deep Star regulator. He would have preferred a newer model, but beggars couldn't be choosy. He considered himself lucky that one of the young consulate members made a sport of diving and had the equipment on hand. He attached the regulator to the valve of an air bottle. Two single tanks were all he could scrounge. Enough for 15 minutes diving, and even that was stretching precious time for dives to 140 feet. His only consolation was that he wouldn't be down long enough to worry about decompression. His last look of the Grimsey's deck before the blue-green water closed over his face mask was of Admiral Sandecker sitting sleepily with fishing pole gripped in both hands, and Teedy, dressed in Pitt's outlandish clothes, brown hair encased in the knit cap, studiously sketching the Icelandic shoreline. Shielded from anyone watching from the cliffs, Pitt slipped over the side behind the wheelhouse and became a part of the sea's vastness. His body was tense. Without a diving companion, there was no margin for error. The shock of the icy water against his sweating body nearly made him pass out. Using the anchor line as a guide, he followed along its vanishing outline, leaving his air bubbles to swirl and rise lazily to the surface. As he sank deeper and deeper, the light diminished and the visibility shortened. He checked his two vital references. The depth gauge read 90 feet, and the orange dial on the Doxa diving watch notified him that he had been down 2 minutes. The bottom gradually came into view. He automatically popped his ears for the third time and was struck by the color of the sand. A pure black. Unlike most areas of the world where the bottom sand was white, the volcanic activity of Iceland had left a carpet of soft ebony grains. He slowed his movement, spellbound by the strangeness of the dark color beneath the vast shroud of blue-green water. Visibility was about 40 feet, quite good considering the depth. Instinctively, he swung around in a 360-degree circle. Nothing was in sight. He looked up and vaguely saw a shadow pass over him. It was a small school of cod foraging near the bottom for their favorite diet of shrimp and crab. He watched a moment as they slowly slipped overhead, their slightly flattened bodies tinted a dark olive and spotted with hundreds of small brown dots. Too bad the Admiral can't hook one, he thought. The smallest weighed no less than 15 pounds. Pitt began swimming in ever-widening circles around the anchor line, dragging a fin in the sand to mark his trail. Underwater, he often saw fantasy. At deep depths, his perception was distorted, danger magnified beyond clear thinking. After 5 circuits, he saw a dim form through the blue haze. Quickly kicking his fins, he swam toward it. 30 seconds later, his hopes were broken and discarded. The form proved to be a large, jagged rock poking up from the bottom like some forgotten and crumbling outpost in the middle of a desert. Effortlessly, he slipped around the current-worn sides, his mind blurred, struggling for control. This couldn't be the reading on the fathometer, he thought. The peak was too conical to match that of an aircraft fuselage. Then he saw something lying in the sand just 5 feet away. The black paint on the broken and bent door blended against the black sand almost to the point of invisibility. He swam forward and turned it over, recoiling in surprise for an instant as a large lobster scurried from its new home. There were no markings anywhere on the inside paneling. Pitt had to move quickly now. The plane had to be very close, but he was due to pull the valve for his reserve air, and that only left a few minutes of extra breathing, barely enough to get him to the surface. It didn't take him long to find it. The aircraft was resting on its belly, broken too, evidence of the impact from the crash. His breathing came harder now, signaling him that it was time to go on reserve. He pulled the valve and headed for the top. The watery ceiling over his head slowly became brighter as he rose along with his air bubbles. At 30 feet he stopped and searched for the Grimsey's keel. It was important that he break water out of sight from shore. She sat like a fat duck with her props tucked into her bottom, rolling drunkenly with the swells. He stared upward at the sun to get a direction. The Grimsey had drifted around her anchor line on a 180-degree arc so that her starboard side now faced the coast. He pulled himself over the port freeboard and, dropping his air tank, crawled across the deck into the wheelhouse. Sandecker, without looking up, slowly placed his rod against the railing and just as slowly walked over and leaned in the doorway.
"I hope you've had better luck than I have."
"She's lying 150 feet off the starboard beam," Pitt said. "I didn't have time to search the interior. My air was scraping bottom."
"Better get out of that suit and have a cup of coffee. Your face is as blue as a windmill on a Delftware saucer."
"Keep the coffee hot. I'll relax as soon as we've got what we came for." Pitt started for the door. Sandecker's eyes were set. "You're not going anywhere for the next hour and a half. We still have plenty of time. The day is young. It's senseless to overdo your physical resources. You know the repetitive dive charts as well as any diver alive. Two dives to 140 feet within 30 minutes invites a case of the bends." He paused, then drove the point home. "You've seen men scream their lungs out from the agony of pain. You know the ones who lived and the ones who were paralyzed for life. Even if I pushed this old scow to the hilt, I couldn't get you to Reykjavik before 2 hours. Then add another 5 hours on a jet to London and the nearest decompression chamber. No way, my friend. You go below and rest up. I'll tell you when you can go down again."
"No contest, Admiral. You win."
Pitt unzipped the front of his wetsuit. "However, I think it would be wiser to sack out above deck so that all three of us are in view."
"Who's to see? The coast is deserted, and we haven't met another boat since we left the harbor."
"The coast isn't deserted. We have an observer." Sandecker turned and gazed across the water toward the cliffs.
"I may be getting old, but I don't need glasses yet. Damned if I can detect any obvious signs."
"Off to the right, just beyond that rock that projects from the water."
"Can't see crap from this distance."
He stared sideways at the point Pitt described.
"It'd be like looking through a keyhole and seeing another eye if I picked up the binoculars and stared back. How can you be sure?"
"There was a reflection. The sun flashed on something for a moment. Probably a pair of lenses.
Let them gawk. If anybody should ask why only two of us were on deck, TD was seasick and in misery on a bunk below."
"That's as good an excuse as any," Pitt said, smiling. "So long as they can't tell the difference between TD and me and that wild set of duds."
Sandecker laughed. "Through binoculars from a mile away, your own mother couldn't tell the difference."
"I'm not sure how I should take that."
Sandecker turned and stared into Pitt's eyes, his lips twisting from the laugh to a wry smile. "Don't try. Just get your ass below. It's nappy time. I'll send TD down with a cup of coffee. And no hanky-panky. I know how horny you get after a hard day's dive."
An eerie yellow-gray light showed through the hatch when Sandecker shook Pitt awake. He woke slowly, mind blurred, more groggy from a catnap than from an 8-hour sleep. Pitt could feel the drop in the wave action. The Grimsey was barely rocking, even in the low even swells. There was no hint of a breeze. The air was damp and heavy.
"A change in the weather, Admiral?"
"A fog bank, rolling in from the south."
"How long?"
15, maybe 20 minutes."
"Not much time."
"Enough. Enough for a quick dive." Minutes later, Pitt had slipped into his gear and dropped over the side. Down again into a world where there is no sound, no wind. Down where air is not known. He cleared his ears and kicked his fins hard and descended, his muscles cold and aching, his brain still sluggish from sleep. He swam silently, effortlessly, as though suspended by a wire through the great fluid backdrop. He swam through the darkening colors, the blue-green now changing slowly to a soft gray. He swam with no sense of direction, save for what his instinct and the landmarks on the bottom told him. Then he found it. His heart began pounding like a bass drum as he approached the plane cautiously, knowing from experience that once he entered the tangled wreckage, every movement would be a menace. He flippered around to the shattered opening of the fuselage 8 feet aft of the wings and was greeted by a small rosefish, no more than 6 inches long. Its orange-red scales contrasted vividly with the dark background and fluoresced in the dim light like a tiny Christmas tree ornament. It stared at Pitt for a moment from one beady eye set solidly under a spiny head, then began darting back and forth in front of his face mask as he entered the plane.
As soon as his eyes adjusted to the darkness, they met with a jumbled mess of seats, broken from their moorings on the floor, and wooden boxes floating in confusion against the ceiling. Tugging two of the boxes toward the opening, he pushed them out and watched until they lifted free on their way toward the surface. Then he spied a glove with its finger socket still encasing a man's hand. The body attached by a greenish arm to the hand was jammed between the seats in the lower corner of the main cabin. Pitt pulled the corpse out and searched its clothing. He must have been the one who fired the machine gun from the doorway, Pitt reasoned. The head wasn't a pretty sight. It had been smashed to semi-liquid paste, the gray matter and skull fragments straggling in reddish tentacles away from the center mass and swaying in unison with the current. The pockets of the torn black overalls covering the remains held nothing but a screwdriver. Pitt shoved the screwdriver under his weight belt. Then, half swimming, half gliding, he entered the cockpit. Except for a broken windshield on the co-pilot's side, the heart of the aircraft appeared empty and undamaged. But then he happened to look up at his air bubbles rising to the overhead panel and traveling like a silver snake in search of an escape exit. They eventually ran together and clustered in one corner, encircling another corpse, pushed up there by internal gases expanding under the decomposing flesh. The dead pilot wore the same type of black overalls. A quick search revealed nothing. The pockets were empty. The little rosefish wiggled past Pitt and began nibbling on the bulging right eye of the pilot. Panting heavily, Pitt pushed the body upward out of the way. He fought an urge to vomit into his mouthpiece and waited until he regained control of his breathing again. He glanced at the doxa watch. He had only been down for 9 minutes, not the 90 his imagination suggested. There was little time left. Quickly he groped around the small enclosure looking for a logbook, a maintenance or checkout list, anything with printing on it. The cockpit kept its secret well. There was no record of any kind. Not even a sticker with the aircraft's call letters adhering to the face of the radio transmitter. It was like leaving the womb, being born again when he emerged from the plane. The open water was darker now than when he had entered. After checking the tail section, he kicked over to the starboard engine. No hope here. It was almost totally buried in the bottom silt. He got lucky on the port engine. Not only was it easily accessible, but the cowling had broken off, leaving the turbine casing bare for inspection. But fate wasn't playing the game. He discovered the area where the identification plate should have been. It was gone. Only the four little brass screws that once held it remained, neatly set in their threads. Pitt slammed his fist against the casing in frustration. It was useless to look further. He knew all identifying marks on instruments, electrical components, and other mechanical units on the plane would be erased. Silently, he cursed the brain behind the thoroughness. It seemed uncanny that one man should have considered and planned for every conceivable contingency. In spite of the near-freezing water, trickles of sweat rolled down his face under the mask. His mind was turning aimlessly, posing problems and questions, but impotent to come up with solutions. Without thinking, without controlled effort, his eyes began following the antics of the rosefish. It had trailed him from the cockpit, and was cavorting around a silver object a few feet beyond the bow of the plane. Pitt kept his eyes on the little fish for nearly 30 seconds, aware of nothing except the sound of his exhaust bubbles, before he finally reacted and recognized the long silver tube as the hydraulic shock absorber of the nose wheel. Swiftly he was over it, studying the cylinder carefully. The crash had torn it from the support strut, and, together with the tire and wheel, had thrown the assembly out from under the nose section. It was the same story. The manufacturer's serial number had been filed from the aluminum housing. Then, as he was about to head toward the surface, he threw a last quick look down. On the end section of the housing, where the hydraulic tubing had pulled from its connection, Pitt spotted a small marking. Two roughly gouged letters in the metal. S.C. Taking the screwdriver from his weight belt, he etched his initials next to the other marking. The depth of his DP matched that of the SC. Okay, no sense in hanging around, he reasoned. His air was becoming difficult to inhale, the signal that his tank was getting low. He pulled his reserve valve and moved upward. The rosefish followed him until he turned and waved his hand in its path, sending the little marine creature scurrying behind a friendly rock. Pitt smiled and nodded. His playful companion would have to find a new friend. Pitt arched on his back at 50 feet, looking directly up at where the surface should have been, trying to get his bearings in relation to the Grimsey. The light was equal in all directions. Only his ascending bubbles indicated the direction of his native element. It slowly began to get lighter, but it was still much darker than when he dropped off the Grimsey's side. Pitt's anxious head broke water to be engulfed by a thick cloak of fog. God, he thought, this soup makes it impossible to find the boat. To strike out for shore would have been at best a 4-to-1 gamble. Pitt unshouldered his air tank harness, tied it to his already unhooked weight belt, and let them fall together to the bottom. Now he could float comfortably, thanks to the buoyancy of his rubber wetsuit. He lay quietly, barely breathing, listening for a sound through the dense gray blanket. At first he could hear only the water lapping around his body. Then his ears picked up a faint, gravelly voice, a voice singing a flat version of "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean." Pitt cupped his ears, amplifying the sound, determining the direction. He struck out with an easy, energy-saving breaststroke for 50 feet and then stopped. The off-key singing had increased in volume. 5 minutes later, he touched the sea-worn hull of the Grimsey and pulled himself on board. "Have a nice swim?" Sandecker asked conversationally. "Hardly enjoyable and barely profitable." Pitt unzipped the wetsuit top, revealing a dense mat of black chest hair. He grinned at the admiral. "Funny thing, I could swear I heard a foghorn." "That was no foghorn, that was a former baritone of the Annapolis Glee Club, class of 39. "You were never in better voice, admiral." Pitt looked Sandecker in the eye. "Thanks." Sandecker smiled. "Don't thank me, thank Teedy. She had to sit through 10 choruses. She materialized out of the mist and hugged him. "Thank God you're safe." She clung to him, the dampness trickling down her face, her hair falling in matted tendrils. "It's nice to know I've been missed." She stood back. "Missed? That's putting it mildly. Admiral Sandecker and I were beginning to come unglued."
"Speak for yourself, Miss Royal," Sandecker said sternly.
"You didn't fool me for a second, admiral. You were worried."
"Concerned is the word," Sandecker corrected. "I take it as a personal insult when any of my men get themselves killed."
He turned his gaze to Pitt.
"Did you find anything of value?"
2 bodies and little else. Somebody went to a hell of a lot of work to remove the plane's identification. Every serial number on every piece of equipment had to be removed before the crash. The only markings were 2 letters scratched on the nose gear's hydraulic cylinder. He gratefully accepted a towel from Teedy. "The boxes I sent up, did you retrieve them?"
"It wasn't easy," Sandecker said. "They broke surface about 40 feet away. 20 tries later, I haven't cast with a pole in years, I managed to hook and reel them in."
"You opened them?" Pitt probed.
"Yes, they're miniature models of buildings, like dollhouses."
Pitt straightened. "Dollhouses? You mean 3-dimensional architectural exhibits?"
"Call them what you want."
Sandecker paused to flip a cigar stub overboard.
"Damn fine craftsmanship. The detail on each structure is amazing. They even break away by floors so you can study the interior."
"Let's take a look."
"We carried them to the galley," Sandecker said. "It's as good a place as any to get you into some dry clothes and a cup of hot coffee into your stomach."
Teedy had already changed back into her own blouse and slacks. She demurely turned her back as Pitt finished stripping off the wetsuit before he donned his colorful mod outfit. He smiled while she busied herself over the galley stove.
"Did you keep them warm for me?" he asked.
"Your gay threads?" She turned and stared at him, her face showing the beginning signs of a blush. "Are you kidding? You're at least 8 inches taller, and you outweigh me by nearly 60 pounds. I literally swam in the damn things. It was as if I was wearing a tent. The cold air swept up my legs and out my neck and arms like a hurricane.
I sincerely hope it didn't cause any critical damage to your vital parts."
"If you're referring to my future sex life, I fear the worst."
"My sympathies, Miss Royal."
Sandecker didn't sound very convincing. He lifted the boxes onto the table and pulled off the lids.
"Okay, here they are, including furniture and draperies."
Pitt looked into the first box.
"No indications of water damage."
"They were watertight," Sandecker offered. "Each packed so carefully, the crash left them entirely intact."
To say the models were simply masterpieces of diminutive art would have been a gross understatement. The Admiral was right. The detail was amazing. Every brick, every window pane was precise in scale and placement. Pitt lifted off the roof. He had seen model exhibits before in museums, but never workmanship like this. Nothing had been overlooked. Paintings on the walls were exacting in color and design. The furniture had tiny designs printed on the fabric. Telephones on desks had receivers that could be picked up, connected to wires that led into the walls. As a crowning touch, the bathrooms even possessed toilet paper rolls that unraveled to the touch. The first model building consisted of four floors and a basement. Pitt carefully lifted them off one at a time, studied the contents, and just as carefully replaced them. Then he inspected the second model. "I know this one," Pitt said quietly. Sandecker looked up. "Are you sure?" "Positive. It's pink. You don't often forget a structure built of pink marble. It was about 6 years ago when I entered those walls. My father was on an economic survey mission for the president, conferring with the heads of finance in Latin American governments. I took a 30-day leave from the Air Force and acted as his aide and pilot during the trip. Yes, I remember it well, especially this exotic, black-eyed little secretary." "Spare us your erotic escapades," Sandecker said impatiently. "Where is it located?" "In El Salvador. This model is a perfect, scaled-down replica of the Dominican Republic Capitol building." He gestured toward the first model. "Judging from the design, the other model also represents the legislative offices of another South or Central American country." "Great," Sandecker said unenthusiastically. "We've come up with a character who collects miniature capitals. It doesn't tell us a hell of a lot." Teedy handed Pitt a cup of coffee, and he sipped it thoughtfully. "Except that the black jet was doing double duty." Sandecker met his gaze. "You mean it was delivering these models when it changed course to shoot down you and Honeywell?" "Exactly. One of Rondheim's fishing trawlers probably spotted our helicopter approaching Iceland and diverted the jet by radio so it would be waiting for us when we reached the coast." "Why Rondheim? I see nothing tangible that ties him in with any of this." "Any port in a storm." Pitt shrugged. "I admit I'm groping. And at that, I'm not completely sold on implicating Rondheim myself. He's like the butler in an old movie mystery. Every piece of circumstantial evidence, every finger of doubt, points to him, making him the most obvious suspect. But in the end, our friendly butler turns out to be an undercover policeman, and the least obvious character turns out to be the guilty party. Somehow, I can't picture Rondheim as an undercover cop." Sandecker crossed the cabin and poured himself another cup of coffee. "But he's just enough of a prick for me to fervently wish that in some form or manner he's behind Fury's and Honeywell's death, so we could zero in on the bastard and nail him to the floor. It wouldn't be easy. He's in a pretty solid position." "If you ask me," Teedy interjected, "you two schemers are jealous of Rondheim because of his hold over Miss Fury." Pitt laughed. "You have to be in love to be jealous." Sandecker grinned at her. "Your forked tongue is showing, lady." "I'm not being catty out of spite. I like Kirsty Fury." "I suppose you like Oscar Rondheim, too," Pitt said. "I wouldn't like that snake if he was general of the Salvation Army," she said. "But you have to give the devil his due. He's got Kirsty and Fury Limited tucked neatly in his pocket." "Why?" "Answer that," Pitt said speculatively. "How can Kirsty love him if she's terrified of him?" Teedy shook her head. "I don't know. I still see the pain in her eyes when he squeezed her neck."
"Maybe she's a masochist and Rondheim's a sadist," Sandecker said.
"If Rondheim is masterminding these terrible murders, you must turn everything you know over to the proper authorities," Teedy pleaded. "If you persist in pushing this thing too far, both of you might be killed."
Pitt made a sad face. "It's shameful, Admiral. Your own secretary is vastly underestimating her two favorite people." He turned and looked dolefully at Teedy. "How could you?" Sandecker sighed. "It's almost impossible to find loyalty in an employee these days."
"Loyalty?"
Teedy looked at them as if they had gone mad.
"What other girl would let herself be dragged over half the world in uncomfortable military cargo planes, frozen on smelly old boats in the middle of the North Atlantic, and be subjected to constant male harassment for the meager salary I'm paid? If that isn't loyalty, I'd like to know what you typical inconsiderate men call it."
"Crap, that's what I call it," Sandecker said. He put his hands on her shoulders and looked warmly into her eyes.
Believe me, Titi, I value your friendship and your concern for my welfare very highly, and I'm certain Dirk prizes you just as highly. But you must understand, a close friend and three of my people have been murdered, and an attempt made on Dirk here. I'm not the kind of guy who hides under a mattress and calls a cop. By God, this whole bung-twisting mess was pushed on us by persons unknown. When we find out who they are, then and only then will I stand back and let the law and its enforcers take over. Are you with me? The surprise of Sandecker's sudden display of affection held, then slowly passed from Titi's face, and big tears began to well in her eyes. She pressed her head against the Admiral's chest.
I feel such a monkey, she murmured. I'm always shooting off my mouth. Next time it runs away from me, please stuff a gag in it.
You can count on it, he said more softly than Pitt had ever heard him. Sandecker held Titi another minute before he released her. Okay, let's up anchor and get the hell back to Reykjavik. The old familiar gravel tone was back. I could use a nice hot toddy. Pitt suddenly stiffened, held up a hand for silence, and stepped to the wheelhouse doorway and listened intently. It was very faint, but it was there. Through the blanket of mist it came as a steady drone, the sound of an engine running at very high RPMs.